Chapter 7. Discomfiture, indeed, the very possibility of such annexations, was unknown to them, who supposed that, though to be well favored might be the gift of fortune, a family name came by nature. Tess still stood hesitating like a bather about to make his plunge, hardly knowing whether to retreat or to persevere, when a figure came forth from the dark triangular door of the tent. It was that of a tall young man, smoking. He had an almost swarthy complexion, with full lips, badly molded, though red and smooth, above which was a well-groomed black mustache with curled points, though his age could not be more than 24. Despite the touches of barbarism in his contours, there was a singular force in the gentleman's face, and in his bold rolling eye. "Well, my beauty, what can I do for you?" said he, coming forward, and perceiving that she stood quite confounded, "Never mind me. I am Mr. D'Urberville. Have you come to see me or my mother?" This embodiment of a D'Urberville and a namesake differed even more from what Tess had expected than the house and grounds had differed. As he had dreamed of an aged and dignified face, the sublimation of all the D'Urberville lineaments, furrowed with incarnate memories representing in hieroglyphic the centuries of her family's and England's history. But she screwed herself up to the work in hand, since she could not get out of it, and answered, "I came to see your mother, sir." "I am afraid you cannot see her, she is an invalid," replied the present representative of the spurious house, for this was Mr. Alec, the only son of the lately deceased gentleman. "And did I answer your purpose? What is the business you wish to see her about?" "It isn't business, it is I can hardly say what." "Pleasure? Oh no. Why, sir, if I tell you, it will seem." Tessa's sense of a certain ludicrousness in her errand was now so strong that, notwithstanding her awe of him, and her general discomfort at being here, her rosy lips curved towards a smile, much to the attraction of the swarthy Alexander. "It is so very foolish," she stammered. "I fear can't tell you." "Never mind. I like foolish things." "Try again, my dear," said he kindly. "Mother asked me to come," Tess continued. "And, indeed, I was in the mind to do so myself likewise. But I did not think it would be like this. I came, sir, to tell you that we are of the same family as you."
"Oh, poor relations?"
"Yes."
"Stokes?"
"No, D'Urbervilles."
I mean D'Urbervilles.
Our names are worn away to Derbyfield, but we have several proofs that we are D'Urbervilles. Antiquarians hold we are, and we have an old seal, marked with a ramping lion on a shield, and a castle over him. And we have a very old silver spoon, round in the bowl like a little ladle, and marked with the same castle. But it is so worn that mother uses it to stir the pea soup. "A castle argent is certainly my crest," said he blandly. "And my arms a lion rampant. And so mother said we ought to make ourselves beckon to you as we've lost our horse by a bad accident, and are the oldest branch o' the family."
"Very kind of your mother, I'm sure. And I, for one, don't regret her step."
Alec looked at Tess as he spoke, in a way that made her blush a little. "And so, my pretty girl, you've come on a friendly visit to us, as relations?"
"I suppose I have," faltered Tess, looking uncomfortable again.
"Well, there's no harm in it. Where do you live? What are you?" She gave him brief particulars, and responding to further inquiries told him that she was intending to go back by the same carrier who had brought her. "It is a long while before he returns past Trantridge Cross. Supposing we walk round the grounds to pass the time, my pretty coz?" Tess wished to abridge her visit as much as possible, but the young man was pressing, and she consented to accompany him. He conducted her about the lawns, and flower beds, and conservatories, and thence to the fruit garden and greenhouses, where he asked her if she liked strawberries.
"Yes," said Tess, "when they come. They are already here."
D'Urberville began gathering specimens of the fruit for her, handing them back to her as he stooped, and, presently, selecting a specially fine product of the brightish queen variety, he stood up, and held it by the stem to her mouth. "No, no," she said quickly, putting her fingers between his hand and her lips. "Would rather take it in my own hand." "Nonsense," he insisted, and in a slight distress she parted her lips, and took it in. They had spent some time wandering desultorily thus, Tess eating in a half-pleased, half-reluctant state whatever d'Urberville offered her. When she could consume no more of the strawberries, he filled her little basket with them, and then the two passed round to the rose trees, whence he gathered blossoms, and gave her to put in her bosom. She obeyed like one in a dream, and when she could affix no more, he himself tucked a bud or two into her hat, and heaped her basket with others, in the prodigality of his bounty. At last, looking at his watch, he said, "Now, by the time you have had something to eat, it will be time for you to leave, if you want to catch the carrier to Shaston. Come here, and I'll see what grub I can find." Stoke d'Urberville took her back to the lawn and into the tent, where he left her, soon reappearing with a basket of light luncheon, which he put before her himself. It was evidently the gentleman's wish, not to be disturbed in this pleasant tete-a-tete by the servantry. "Do you mind my smoking?" he asked. "Oh, not at all, sir." He watched her pretty and unconscious munching through the skeins of smoke that pervaded the tent, and Tess Durbeyfield did not divine, as she innocently looked down at the roses in her bosom, that there behind the blue narcotic haze was potentially the tragic mischief of her drama, one who stood fair to be the blood-red ray in the spectrum of her young life. She had an attribute which amounted to a disadvantage just now. And it was this that caused Alec d'Urberville's eyes to rivet themselves upon her. It was a luxuriance of aspect, a fullness of growth, which made her appear more of a woman than she really was. As he had inherited the feature from her mother without the quality it denoted. It had troubled her mind occasionally, till her companions had said that it was a fault which time would cure. She soon had finished her lunch. "How I am going home, sir," she said, rising. "And what do they call you?" he asked, as he accompanied her along the drive till they were out of sight of the house. "Tess Durbeyfield, down at Marlott." "And you say your people have lost their horse?" "I killed him," she answered, her eyes filling with tears as she gave particulars of Prince's death. "Andy, I don't know what to do for father on account of it. I must think, if I cannot do something. My mother must find a berth for you. But, Tess, no nonsense about d'Urberville. Durbeyfield only, you know quite another name." "I wish for no better, sir," said she with something of dignity. For a moment, only for a moment, when they were in the turning of the drive, between the tall rhododendrons and conifers, before the lodge became visible, he inclined his face towards her as if, but, no. He thought better of it, and let her go. Thus the thing began. Had she perceived this meeting's import, she might have asked why she was doomed to be seen and coveted that day by the wrong man, and not by some other man, the right and desired one in all respects, as nearly as humanity can supply the right and desired. Yet to him who amongst her acquaintance might have approximated to this kind, she was but a transient impression, half forgotten. In the ill-judged execution of the well-judged plan of things, the call seldom produces the comer, the man to love rarely coincides with the hour for loving. Nature does not often say he to her poor creature at a time when seeing can lead to happy doing, or reply here to a body's cry of here. Till the hide and seek has become an irksome, outworn game. We may wonder whether at the acme and summit of the human progress these anachronisms will be corrected by a finer intuition, a close interaction of the social machinery than that which now jolts us round and along, but such completeness is not to be prophesied, or even conceived as possible. Enough that in the present case, as in millions, it was not the two halves of a perfect whole that confronted each other at the perfect moment, A missing counterpart wandered independently about the earth waiting in crass obtuseness till the late time came. Out of which maladroit delay sprang anxieties, disappointments, shocks, catastrophes, and passing strange destinies. When D'Urberville got back to the tent he sat down astride on a chair reflecting, with a pleased gleam in his face. Then he broke into a loud laugh. Well, I'm damned. What a funny thing. Ha ha ha. And what a crummy girl. Vi, Tess went down the hill to Trantridge Cross, and inattentively waited to take her seat in the van returning from Chaseboro to Shaston. She did not know what the other occupants said to her as she entered, though she answered them, and when they had started anew she rode along with an inward, and not an outward eye. One among her fellow travelers addressed her more pointedly than any had spoken before, colon why, you be quite a posy. And such roses in early June. Then she became aware of the spectacle she presented to their surprised vision. Roses at her breasts, roses in her hat, roses and strawberries in her basket to the brim. She blushed, and said confusedly, that the flowers had been given to her. When the passengers were not looking, she stealthily removed the more prominent blooms from her hat, and placed them in basket, where she covered them with her handkerchief. Then she fell to reflecting again, and in looking downwards a thorn of the rose remaining in her breast accidentally pricked her chin. Like all the cottagers in Blackmoor Vale, Tess was steeped in fancies and prefigurative superstitions. She thought this an ill omen the first as he had noticed that day. The van traveled, only so far as Shaston, and there were several miles of pedestrian descent from that mountain town into the Vale of Marlott. Her mother had advised her to stay here for the night, at the house of a cottage woman they knew, if she should feel too tired to come on, and this Tess did, not descending to her home till the following afternoon. When she entered the house she perceived in a moment from her mother's triumphant manner that something had occurred in the interim. Oh yes, I know all about it. I told thee it would be all right, and now 'tis proved. Since I've been away? What has? Said Tess rather wearily. Her mother surveyed the girl up and down with arch approval, and went on banteringly, colon so you've brought 'em round. How do you know, mother? I've had a letter. Tess then remembered that there would have been time. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.